Of course.
I have on the panel here, not just the four or five speakers you've already heard, but the two on the extreme ends of the platform, of the spectrum, who are going to be speaking tomorrow. So just to introduce them, that's Peter Gibson this end, and Terry Duco, who's come all the way from Chicago. Ooh. Oh, a wise sketch. And the credits. And I'm going to ask each of the four main speakers to give a 2-minute summary of what they said. So the older ones among us will remind you. And then I will ask the questions from the floor for the whole panel or any number of people on the panel, which they can then answer if they feel inspired. Unlike Marianne, I have no secure capacity for remembering names. So are they saying things like, oh, you then? And I just hope that it's the right person.
Are you sure you mean them to have 2 minutes each? Because that's 15 minutes.
No, only the four.
I'll take less than 2 minutes.
Yes. No, I'm not going to let the two on the extremes summarise this before.
I spoke about William James' radical empiricism. I was really introducing the idea that there is another take on empiricism rather than traditional ideas that we're all used to. It was on the basis of very little knowledge, really, because I've only come across it a few months ago. I just found it very interesting. And to me, it sort of actually draws together what might actually be a false distinction between rationalism and empiricism. I don't think it's necessarily a one thing or the other. And actually, I just remembered what I was trying to remember that you said about Einstein making a difference in science, because Einstein, it could be said, used a rationalist approach by thinking through ideas to deal with an empirical problem. You know, that was the sort of thing that I was talking about there. William James, radical empiricism. I'll pass you over.
I think or I claim that the committed empiricist needs to know only what we need in the work terms of abilities in order to be able to understand the world. And my claim is that that is actually much less than might appear at first sight, in spite of the fact that what people think of as raw data is not data at all, because it is raw. Somehow we've got to get from the raw to the data, and that can be done with a very simple kit indeed. But we do have a starter kit, and there is empirical evidence that we have a lot more than those simple tools, such as language, such as the ability to see continuity in objects, such as perception of edges, etc., etc. But it's the idea of the starter kit is very important. But it is still, that is an empiricist idea.
Do I need this as well?
Well, if you, yes, I would. If I, oh, you've got that. No, is it switched on?
Oh. Switched on. Right. I'd like to correct any impression I might have given that Chomsky is not in favour of the scientific method and the empirical gathering of data. It's just that he believes that his explanation of certain phenomena requires going beyond testable hypotheses in order to explain it. Professor Eyre, who's really no friend to the rationalist approach, did say that although he thought that behaviourist account could explain language, he said nevertheless more has been learned since 1950, when Chomsky came on the scene, than had about language than in the whole previous 2,000 years. There is a lot of factual data that Chomsky has developed, and for instance the Chomsky hierarchy or the automata that required for generating different languages, which is good scientific work. But he uses it to show that the language itself is so complex But a learning theory would be incredibly complex for children to learn it. And so, by default, the only explanation is that they have what you might call an innate mechanism, but we could use more modern terminology to explain how it is that when the child gets the input of the language, it's able to go straight to the correct hypothesis. Because, he would say, there is only one hypothesis available in their cognitive plan. Because if there were too many, they would never be able to work out how the thing fit together. So, I'm sorry, that's not really a summary of what I said, but I just wanted to say that it was perhaps unwise for me to say that I wasn't going to mention anything about linguistics, because that's rather missing the point of his evidence. Sorry.
Where's the switch on?
Is
it on?
Yeah.
Right. I was saying the same thing broadly about our understanding of learning that has just been said about Chomsky and language, that we've learned more in the last few years than in a few thousand years of talking about it. I put it another way, I would add one more test to Hume's too. Does it contain any demonstration? Does it contain any experimental reporting? I would add, if it is a discussion, does it lead to any operational difference? If it does, it's very valuable, whether it's done by somebody calling themselves a philosopher or somebody calling himself a scientist. It's thinking about the results and then saying, well, this could mean so and so, could mean something else, and actually then finding the crucial set of experiments which will help you to tell the difference that advances things. If people are going to simply speculate in a way which makes no operational difference, then I'm with you. Consign it to the flames. Sophistry.
Right, thank you to the four speakers. I see a hand has been up immediately. What I'll do is I'll try and write down either names or descriptions, which you're not allowed to see afterwards.
were three questions left over from four before, so don't forget.
Right. You've got the three questions that I've forgotten.
I'm one of the leftovers.
Yours is a leftover question. Anne's a leftover?
No,
oh, I'm sorry.
Mine's new.
Anne, Werner, and Peter.
Peter, right, okay. Well, in that case, I'll get those out of the way and then come to you. Anne, your question.
Yes, a question to Johnson. It was an absolute delight for me to hear your talk. Absolutely wonderful. To get, particularly to get Piaget in there, I would add Vygotsky. Piaget and Vygotsky together are the absolute giants, I think, in enabling us to start thinking scientifically about how we come to understand things. But I wanted to say that I can't see any evidence in either of them for anything remotely called an innate idea. I mean, what Piaget builds on are the reflexes. He says the child is born with the rooting reflex, touch one side of its cheek, it'll turn. Good idea, because it'll turn to the nipple. The Morrow reflex, fling out your four things. Good idea if you're falling down, because it'll spread the weight. And I forgot, you know, there are six of them. And those, he's happy to say, Piaget would say, those are innate. But nothing remotely like an innate idea, either in him or Vygotsky. Would you agree with that?
I don't really know enough about it, and I think it depends. What they do seem to have is not just some of those instincts are instincts with how to recognise something and how to react. Some of those instincts are instincts of how to recognise something and how to react. One of them is the reaction to a breast or something that feels like a breast. You get sucking. As I understood it, the scientists who had studied it were satisfied that at a very, very early age, children reacted, infants reacted differently to the mere sight of something that had what, from their point of view, was just two blotches in the position of the eyes, and an appropriate sort of blotch for the mouth, and seem to register it as something worth a different sort of attention from any old set of blotches or discolorations. They start recognising people, but I won't try and knife edge a distinction between what the infants are doing, because in a sense what their behaviour is so restricted that one is using very few clues as to in what sense what they do represents an innate programme.
Yeah, could I just add one thing, is that right?
Yes.
In psychology originally, I think we made big mistakes when we were talking about what the very young infant could do. I mean, for example, in the very early experiments about recognising faces, in the fancy looking chamber type experiments, what we didn't notice, until some people pointed it out years later, was that these children who could be put into the looking chamber had to be of a certain age. I forgot what it was, like 2.5 months before they'd even stay there, you know. So they weren't newborns. And with the depth perception, that was the worst one, we were trying to argue that depth perception was innate. And how were we doing it? We were using the visual cliff, you know, whether the baby would climb over onto the... crawl onto the glass side. Well, of course, a baby can't crawl until it's whatever month. We certainly weren't testing newborns, and yet it was presented as, look, depth perception is innate. It would have been 8 months to learn depth perception.
Well, wait a minute. Aren't there also things which suggest that pretty early on, well before they can crawl, they can distinguish something coming at them?
Well, a blink is a reflex. It's one of the six reflexes, you see. That's where Piaget started. He said, beginning the reflexes. Blinking, the Morrow reflex, the rooting reflex, and blinking is one of them. You can't not blink if something's coming towards you.
Yes, fair enough. I don't think I'm going to try, as I said, to put a knife between. Thank you for the points, but I wouldn't like to try and put a knife between the reflex and the response and the kind of program, underlying program that governs the response, because I just don't know enough about it. But it did, a lot of the stuff that I was looking at did suggest that the experiments were conducted well before crawling time and well before speech time, but before even crawling time. There was one of them, the continuity and solidity was, they said, within a few days, I think, in the article I read. Mine is all about third-hand knowledge.
So it seems to me there might be some confusion about the word ideas. We start with reflexes, we talk about abilities, skills, mental structures. Vygotsky talks quite a lot, as I remember, about the way children, as they grow up, change the way they structure their ideas and their language. So all these things are rather different. I've just lumped it all under the word abilities, which seems to me to cover more than... The ideas is too restrictive an idea, and too, it's got too much prejudice in it, like images and ideas about things, theories, all that. Even theory is a pretty debatable idea. So I think one has to be very careful about what we're talking about.
Now, shall I ask, I'll get Peter now to ask his question left over from the final session to Jonathan. Peter is at the moment acting as a member of the floor. And then we'll come on to people who want to ask questions later, if you put your hand up, I've already got two here. Two there I've now got, and then I'll write them down even while the answer's going on.
I do have a question
too. Oh, sorry.
From up here.
Right.
this is a point for Jonathan. He's probably getting tired of the finale. it's about David Hume. I'm just sort of struck by the fact that what I've heard so far, there's been a tendency to lump Locke and Hume together as kind of, you know, the old empiricists. And it seems to me in the things we've been talking about that there's a very important difference, that Locke famously refers to this tabula rasa, this blank page, and this, but this is a very caricatured idea of what empiricism stands for. And David Hume was well aware that this wouldn't do, and he has a doctrine known as associationism, which you've probably met, that ideas relate together by resemblance, contiguity and causation, and these are inner mechanisms. Now, it seems to me, in light of what Jonathan's saying, that he should recognise that Hume did all sorts of things, and he's a great philosopher. One of the things he did is lay down a research programme for empirical psychology, and that this is still going on. Jerry Fodor, for example, who's a theoretician, not a practical thinker, but he's a theoretical thinker about the mind, pays direct homage to David Hume as his great predecessor, and he's come up with all ideas about the modularity of the mind and language of thought and so on. I've heard the professor of psychology at University College pay tribute to Jerry Fodor as the greatest thinker of modern times. Not everyone agrees with that. And connectionism in artificial intelligence is a direct follower from this thing. And it seems to me that the talk that Peter was giving is exactly in the Humean tradition of trying to work out what are the minimal mechanisms in the mind which can take an experience and do something with it by connecting it together in various ways without presuming innate ideas. That you have innate mechanisms, and so it seems to me the centre of this debate, where all of this is going on, is about do we have innate mechanisms which are not ideas, or do we actually have innate ideas? But I certainly want to defend David Hume as in a continuous tradition with the people that he admires, and a very important forebearer of them. But it's more the general point, that point about the debate and what Hume contributed, that I just wanted to chip in. I don't know whether Jonathan wants to send into that.
Briefly, yes. It's very difficult, as I said, to catch Hume out with anything that he doesn't guard himself against somewhere, but he on this point, for example, about causation, he did specifically say, if we talked to Adam, he would have had no basis for making any of those connections that we make between cause and effect. It's habit and custom, and what he was doing, it seems to me, when he talked about habit and custom, was not talking about the habit and custom of any one individual. He was doing as he did with political principles and morals. He was appealing to the broad consensus of human beings passed on, historically and traditionally, to human beings who listen to each other and think and talk to each other, and saying that's the way in which we acquire this idea of causation as a connection between cause and event, not anything innate in our minds. That's what I took him to be saying.
I regard habit as an ability myself, but there we are.
Sorry, just one thing. I just assume that his theory of causation arises from his theory of associations, that there are sort of resemblance between this billiard ball, billiard ball, billiard ball, billiard
ball. But post-experience.
This click goes in here, and these habits build up from associations.
Yeah, they build up. They're not there. He didn't start with them.
Yes. It's a psychological theory which can be researched.
Perry, is your question left over from before speech?
No, it's kind of a general question.
I'll slot you in third then. You'd like to ask a question.
John Spencer, how many members of the panel seriously think that philosophers would do better in future if they leapt out of their armchairs and got themselves to a laboratory with a team of researchers? If anybody does think that, aren't they making what Gilbert Ryle might have called a category mistake?
I'll have a bit of an answer to that. I mean, there is a school of thought in America called XFI, experimental philosophy. I don't know that much about it, but it doesn't seem to really be doing what a philosopher should be doing. I think a philosopher is supposed to be engaged, and it doesn't have to be a philosopher doing it. A scientist can do it, but if the scientist asks the right questions, they're doing philosophy at that point. You know, these are the general overarching questions that the philosopher is concerned with. The experimental work and the picking away at it and stuff like that is the rightful environment for the scientist in that area to be working, I think. And the philosopher looks at the concepts that underlie and overarch. and the logical structure of the arguments that are put forward and things like that. So I do think there's a distinction, but the philosopher needs to be informed by what it is that the scientist is finding out. I think if we cannot count himself as a philosopher, I think if the philosopher ignores that, then often the arguments might be empty, vacuous, not really as effective as they could be. And that's just my opinion on it, I think. But I think you're certainly right, the philosopher should be doing something other than what the scientist does.
Anyone else?
You can follow them on Twitter, by the way.
I think there shouldn't be a distinction between being a scientist or being a philosopher. It's in the same study, the scientist at some stage is being philosophical about the work that he does at some level. So it's not a question of, well, his job is just to do science and the philosopher's job is just to talk about it. So everybody is entitled to be a philosopher and think about the empirical evidence.
My personal view is that both philosophers and scientists would benefit a great deal from knowing a lot more about what each other are actually doing, rather than a scientist being an amateur philosopher and a philosopher being an amateur scientist. And working in a lab is incredibly dull and repetitive, so I don't think anybody would want to do that. But to understand the activity that's going on the other side, really a lot more understanding is needed, it seems to me.
As a taxpayer, never mind the career opportunities for the two lots, I would reckon that the loss to my quality of life, if none of the chairs or lectureships in philosophy of the last 70 years had ever been endowed or paid for, would be negligible, whereas the loss of all the science departments, or even a quarter of them, would be immense, and I probably wouldn't even be here. I'm all for, I mean, I think your point is right. Anybody can study philosophy. Anybody can. I'm an historian. I feel the same way about that. I don't see any reason whatever why public money should be spent on these any more than professors of chess or crossword puzzles.
Can I just say, if you think that the only measure of usefulness is some kind of usable or sellable goods, then of course philosophers don't come out of it very easily. But, you know, there's a much closer connection between philosophers and scientists than is being pretended. It's as if there are two separate species. If science is so successful, why did it take until the 17th century for it to appear? We've been struggling ever since the origins of human beings to understand the world. And we get so far, and then we lose a bit, and then we get an influx of religion which stamps things out, and then we move on and so on. We've made all sorts of progress in stepping back, and that's been done by philosophers as well as by scientists. If you take the ancient Greeks, for example, they got almost to empirical science. But people like Aristotle, talking about whether honeybees were male or female, I mean, he's asking a scientific question, but he then says, well, they can't be female because they carry weapons. and they can't be male because they do all the work. You see, I mean, even though they've been several hundred years of philosophy and proto-science, they still haven't got to where science is. And modern science came out of philosophy and was created by people speculating about what the proper way of looking at the world really was.
Can I add something? Sorry. I just think also, I mean, in artificial intelligence, computer technology, a lot of what has been developed there has come out of philosophy departments. So I think that's been incredibly important in that respect, and I'm sure that there are probably other connections that can be made where philosophy feeds directly into science and actually does better our quality of life, perhaps. So, just that aside.
One quick thing, I was the death of Seamus Heaney the other day. Someone commented in the paper, this is a very important event because we don't live in an economy, we live in a culture. And it seems to me that to denigrate philosophy is to suggest that we just live in an economy. And it seems to me that philosophy is absolutely crucial to our culture, and philosophers and professors of philosophy are extremely important for that.
Thank you all. I'm glad I got under your skin.
Well, could I add, I don't think that there's such a thing that there's non-overlapping magisteria, is it?
Yes.
It's not a question of, oh, well, we'll turn to the philosopher the answer to that question, but we'll turn to the doctor for that question. But philosophy has an impact on every aspect of learning and discovery.
It should have.
Well, I should have, yes.
Right, well, thank you. Do you want to add anything to that question, Kerry, for the answers?
I don't know at this point. Thank you.
Okay, you will be next after Mike. Yeah, just so you
just a general comment on previous discussion. It ought to be the case that there is no difference, or that it's non-overlapping magisteria. But of late, unfortunately, scientists tend to ignore philosophers and vice versa, and that's a fact. And it shouldn't be so. To my question. We heard today quite a lot of interesting stuff about things like, I just lost my question, didn't I? Innate ideas, mechanisms, reflections, abilities, etc. And there was some disagreement on that point from Anne, for example, saying we don't have innate ideas, we have reflexes, things like that. So, first half of my question is, does the panel reckon that there is any fundamental difference between those terms, or are they all trying to describe the same something underneath the starting kit? But more to the point, given that we've got a starting kit, and as a scientist, I am always very aware of the so-called Dan Quine theories, namely that all experimental results are necessarily interpreted in light of a theory, i.e. that all data is theory laden. Given that we have such a starter kit, is it really correct to say that it's completely discarded? That it is not, in fact, railroading the way we structure the world?
I don't know if you're going to start.
So there's two parts to your question there, Mike. I think the first thing, I mean, skills, abilities, things like that, I don't think are the same as innate ideas. I think rationalism is the theory of innate ideas, and I think on that basis it needs to be blown out of the water, because I don't think we come conceptually laden. I think what I was getting from my input into this by William James was that we have biologically evolved facilities or faculties that start us on the path to knowing, right, via learning, finding out, and that this process is experience, and as I described it, it's a sequence of linking up what went before with what comes after, and that would tie in with the Humean idea, I think, that I think Peter was sort of talking about there of the relations, you know, of experience. The second bit, where you're talking about the idea of our interpretation always being theory laden, I mean, I think that is absolutely the case, and I don't think we ever actually, at this stage in our biological development or our evolutionary development, step outside of that, that we always bring something to bear upon experience. But it's just as we develop as individuals, it can become more that we bring to bear. So I don't know if that in any way goes anyway to answering your question, but that's my view on it.
Second question first. I don't think we'll ever understand the theory of the theory by which we develop the theory, because we can't get outside it. Mm-hmm. So yes, this is always theory laden. The best thing we best can hope for is to identify that theory adequately. to pin it down and say what it is and look at it, prod it from the outside. If it's a black box, as somebody said, to identify what goes in and what comes out, and perhaps it will never be open, but no, it's there. What was the first? Oh, yes, ideas. Yes, I think there's a big idea, big difference between ideas and abilities, skills, and mechanisms. Ideas assume some kind of ready-made form. Plato casts a long shadow, let's face it. Although we do have forms in our minds, we have ideals, we have aspirations, we have things towards which we aspire, and they're there, I don't think we're born with them.
When you said were they the same, when you said were we talking about the same things, I think there's a question of language here, and we have to remember that when they were using the quaint language, Mr. Locke's darling notion, and I think that was Barnes that called it that, and innate ideas, and Strawson said that these ideas had been consigned to the lumber room of philosophy, but that's the only language they had at the time, and we can now talk about DNA and inherited. We can use, even though we don't know much about it, we understand what we're saying, and so we don't have to use language like innate ideas. That's one thing. And the other thing is, of course, the actual innate ideas, some of them really were ideas, like knowing right and wrong, moral principles, which they believed you were born knowing. Moral principles, so they were actually ideas that imagined. But I did play a bit fast and loose with some of my translation of Descartes, because I thought, as well as translating him from French, why not translate him into what I think he meant?
I'm not sure about this, but I mean, there are certain aspects, it seems, of our knowing that might give credence to the idea of innate ideas, such as moral imperatives, or the idea of moral imperatives, and mathematical knowledge, and maybe even laws of nature. I'm not sure. But I don't think it is the case that they really come in as innate ideas. I think they are patterns. And I think we have a very good recognition of patterns. That is something to do with our evolutionary biology, something like that, maybe.
Can I?
What do I have to do?
I think I don't want to sound too much like an analytical philosopher, but
yeah,
this is an illustration of good philosophy, because not being sure about what words mean and what you mean when you say things leads simply to confusion. You just think of the years that we worry about the nature of natural laws. Because we use the word natural law, and a law is a thing which tells people what to do, but it prescribes what you do. It was natural to think that natural laws were some God-given laws which told matter, the planets, how to behave. And while we thought of them in that way, as natural laws as being prescriptive, then we were simply making no progress in science. It's only when you work out that some laws are descriptive, they simply describe how things happen, they're not prescriptive, that you can make progress. And that would be a change in conception that philosophers supply and scientists take up. Another one might be, for example, this business of innate reflexes and abilities and concepts. If you hold a baby along your arm, a newborn baby, and you go like that, I shouldn't try to say that, it will clutch. If you put fur on its palms, it will close its fingers on the fur, which presumably is from our ancestry. Now, those are innate reflexes, and they're innate abilities. But has the child got a concept of falling or danger? Well, no. And unless you clarify what the difference is between a reflex and an ability and the concept, you're getting a medal. And we have for years in psychology. You've only got to look at the history of psychology and see the medals that they've made. Look at Freud, for example, a metaphysician.
On innate ideas, it just always struck me, the best example I can think of is a bird building its nest. There are all these examples, you know, where babies sort of do innocent things. You don't have to have an innate idea, but if you try and sort of deconstruct what's going through a bird's head when it's building a nest, it isn't just sort of reacting to something, it's sort of going or getting this tweak, and then eventually builds this rather coherent thing. I just don't see how it can do that. It hasn't got some concept in its mind of what it's trying to do. It doesn't make it, it would just throw twigs all over the place. explain that to me.
That's very easy to say. That's a fixed action pattern,
yeah.
The bird does one thing, it gets some feedback from what it's done, it does another thing.
What's the feedback?
If you take a bower bird, for example, that builds a really ornate nest, if you cut the bottom out of that nest, it'll just lay the eggs into it without noticing that the eggs just go right through it and smash on the ground. It's not intending to do anything, it's just driven from stimulus.
It's just driven. I mean, a better explanation than it's just driven.
It doesn't have a concept. It's not trying to build that.
What's it trying to do then?
when I throw something at you and you duck, okay, that's a stimulus response mechanism. In exactly the same way, the bird is responding to some stimulus.
I spent 3 days building.
But it's a feedback mechanism.
Are we presuming something here that, I mean, you're saying that animals have knowledge?
That's the best evidence I can think of for an innate idea.
I've got Jack Russell, right? And Jack Russell eats carrots. Now this is unusual, most of us don't eat carrots, but this Jack Russell likes carrots. He develops eating carrots, not parrots, carrots. And he keeps the carrots in a drawer, and it knows where the carrots are. Now, I mean, I don't think dogs have this innate idea of carrots, this and easy carrots, or known where it was. So it's learned something and it knows something, but it doesn't know it in the way that we know things. I mean, it hasn't got a language to know it, so I don't know if it's got a concept.
Not being a dog, how do you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. No, I'll go along with you there. I don't know for certain.
Is there someone in the audience who knows about animal psychology?
There's a lovely paper in psychology which is called Do Beavers Build Dams? You know that one?
Do Beavers Build Dams?
To which the answer at the end is no. And the way in which you do the experiment was done was to... Anyway. In a territory where there were beavers, you put... loudspeakers which played the right sound of running water, but covered them all over with leaves, so all you got was the sound of running water. And what did the beavers do? Long, long way away from rivers, they went and splashed mud all over the loudspeakers. They're not building dams, they're throwing mud at a noise. We build dams, beavers don't, they throw mud at noise.
But there's somebody who knows about animal behaviour?
Well, I can make a small contribution.
Yes.
There is evidence that humans are slightly unusual. We're primates, but our developmental programme is being arrested quite early. So that when we're born, we're more like a fetal gorilla. So, which means that we're very vulnerable when we're born, but we have a very plastic brain, which enables us to leap into having very good intellectual abilities. So that comparing, we're not birds. It may be that there are some birds and mammals who have far more developed instincts than we do. We shouldn't assume that so-called lower animals, that we have better or more instincts.
But an instinct isn't the same as an idea, is it?
No. Shall we move on? Shall we move on to another question? Because I've got about two or three.
Terry had to ask his question.
Oh, sorry, no, Terry on next. Yes, that's what I've written. Yes, okay. And then I've got three, I think, on the floor.
You've only got 5 minutes left before
yes.
It's bar time.
Let's have
that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, just a general conversation. I probably could have a general question. I could have jumped in before about philosophy and life overlapping. And that is, I see empiricism as kind of a fractious way of looking at life, with associating ideas and cause and effect, and it doesn't seem to me to offer any sort of unity of experience. I mean, I'm a Kantian, and probably. And so I just wonder, what are people's reactions to that thought? Because some of the opening remarks about concepts and some of the things I've read in empiricism seem to be quite elegant as far as to how concepts are associated, and it does seem to be convincing in some way. So, do we really need reason in order to associate concepts in a way that makes sense with the rest of reality and experience? That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Do we need reason?
Can I just say one thing?
Can I
microphone. I do believe that natural selection has given us a set of reflexes, first of all, abilities and so forth, and eventually form concepts. But it doesn't always get it right. I mean, if you take, for example, our innate view of space, which is three-dimensional, if the physicists are right, we're wrong. And there must be other instances. For example, there are lots, if you read books on psychology and people betting on because it's happened three times, it won't happen there again, and things on like that. Our methods of reasoning are not always accurate. So although we have been equipped by natural selection with prejudices about the world, as it were, preconceptions about the world, they're not always the right ones.
Did you want to say something?
No.
Just to say that there seems to be an analogy, to my mind, with grammar, in that reason is a huge word, grammar is a big word. You could see reason as the skeleton, the grammar, upon which everything else is hung, or you could see the bits. Well, I've singled out as similarities and differences and reflexivity and memory as the soil from which reason grows. There may be a seed somewhere, I have no idea, but and maybe it isn't a one-way business. It isn't that everything hangs on reason or that the bits make reason. Maybe it's a bundle that we call reason. To analyse reason needs a lot of work, because it's, at the moment, it's a word that's flung about rather indiscriminately.
To go back to what you were saying about using the word law and how this is misunderstood, this is of course very much misunderstood in grammar, because people seem to think that the laws of grammar are rules that some professor of English has made, and children have to be taught to get it right. But they're not. They're observations, just like the laws of physics. They are observations about the way the grammar works. The other things that the professors of English teach are regulations. They are things like you mustn't end the sentence with a preposition and so on. But these are not the natural laws of the language. And the study of the laws of the language have suggest that, although Chomsky wouldn't go along with this, that learning theories don't have to necessarily involve reason. They could simply be a product of evolution.
Could I just say one more thing? Is that it seems to be confusing reason with rationalism, because empiricists use reason. So I don't think that's necessarily the case, that those two things ought to be confused in that way.
True.
Right, can I go on to another question?
Because we've only got about one. Brent,
just one very quick one.
I saw your question first.
Just a quickie for Jonathan and Barbara. And this again is on the question of the innate knowledge. Let's just get away from ideas. I'll just call it knowledge for the moment. As Descartes and Plato thought, versus the plain white sheet of Locke, has Jung's archetypal theory shed any light on that? I don't know what research went into his development of his archetype theory. Do you just happen to know whether that is relevant?
Anyone know the answer to that?
No. All I would ask is, if anybody does know anything about it, was it related to any kind of research, or is it just another speculative
idea? That's what I'm asking.
I don't know, but my suspicion is that, as with Freud, it's essentially a question of a speculative idea, which has no particular basis at all, except that you can persuade some people to feel better when they hear about it.
Well, yes, I think it's, without knowing specifically which one you're talking about, it would come under Popper's strictures about what qualifies as a scientific statement, namely that it should be falsifiable, which was different from the test of a meaningful statement, in that that had to be verifiable, or they were looking for a test for meaningfulness, whereas Popper was looking for a test of whether it's a scientific, namely an empirical statement. And I gather, well, certainly Popper said Freudian psychology doesn't come into that category.
No, this is Jung.
Well, yeah. Yes, but I'm afraid I'm just ignorant on that subject.
Okay, thanks.
Right, thank you. I think that's about all we've got time for, isn't it?
I think so. Let's
actually hear from it.